The screenwriter, Martin Daniel, was in Dublin this week as part of a workshop organised by FOSS Screen Training Ireland. This is a part of a series of workshops aimed at enabling filmmakers to develop their own feature film. Part of Martin's presentation was a scene-by-scene analysis of a Czech film, The Shop on Main Street, which won an Oscar for the Best Foreign Language Film in 1965. The film was produced by Martin's father, the late Czech producer Frank Daniel. Martin is carrying on the family tradition as a screenwriter and script consultant, working and tutoring in both America and Europe. We begin by looking at the story of the Oscar-winning film produced by his father, The Shop on Main Street.
The basic story of the movie, it's a guy in a small town in Slovakia. He's kind of a loser, you know, he's not the most important guy in the village, let's say. And he has a brother-in-law who is the fascist leader of the village. And as an attempt to win the favor back of his brother-in-law, of the loser guy, he offers him to Aryanize, which is to become the Aryan controller of an old Jewish lady's shop. And the loser fellow Tono feels that this is his big chance to get ahead in life, but he soon discovers that the shop is nearly bankrupt. But he develops a relationship with the old Jewish widow and actually becomes sort of co-opted into the Jewish community. And eventually, you know, the situation slowly builds to where all of the Jewish people will be deported. And then he plays a critical role in that situation. It's a tragedy. It's a tragic film.
But it's interesting that film has been made in 1963 or thereabouts in Czechoslovakia, and we didn't get to see films like that in the mainstream until Schindler's List in the 80s. Mm.
Well, actually, you know, all of these films had a certain subtext because they were dealing with totalitarianism, and obviously up till that time we had been living in totalitarianism. So I think the main reason Czech filmmakers started focusing on World War II was it was an underhanded way to be able to say things about totalitarianism and, for example, collaboration and, you know, the people who take advantage of political situations for their own benefit, which is what this film deals with. So I think that was really what it was about, you know, and it was in that context you could say things that you otherwise couldn't say before. But as time went on and you got closer to 68, it became more overt. In other words, eventually people got to where they were talking about, you know, the secret police and bugging and all of that in quite open ways. And I think that really brought on the crackdown, you know, as part of what happened.
Couldn't be ignored. Subtle metaphors could be ignored.
It slowly got to where it wasn't subtle metaphors anymore. It was like crying out loud, and then it like could no longer be tolerated by the Soviets, obviously.
But going back to your father, he left Czechoslovakia in the late 60s.
He left in the right after the Prague Spring, so we were actually there for the Soviet invasion in August of 68. And at the time, he was the dean of the Czech Film Academy, FAMU, and that was the period of the Czech New Wave. The films of like Miloš Forman and Věra Chykilová and this film. And so it was the time when Czech cinema was really making a name for itself in the world.
And your father was quite well known, though, at that stage abroad because he'd produced The Shop on Main Street.
And he'd also produced a film called Lemonade Joe, which also was nominated for the Oscar and which also had some play in that was kind of a satire Western. And in fact, because he was the at that time, there were some because there was such interest in the Czech films, there were people coming over to look at the film school, which was quite successful, and they wanted to know what was leading to the success. And so he was actually invited to America to tour around and look at all of the American film schools and give a kind of report for the Ford Foundation of film education in America and the state of it. And that really laid the groundwork for, you know, his possibility of escape because he made the connections at that time that brought him out when the invasion happened.
But going back briefly to The Shop on Main Street, that was produced under the communist regime,
yes,
at a kind of like a pseudo-liberal phase before, yes, they invaded.
Absolutely. Yeah, kind of like, you know, perestroika period in Russia, you know, the perestroika period in Russia. So there was a slow liberalization in the Czech Republic, which really led to the Prague Spring, which was where it really became an open defiance of the Soviets and an attempt to establish a democratic government at that time, and that led to the invasion.
It must be terribly disappointing for people like your father to have contributed to the liberalization of the arts and the culture in the country and then to be trundled under by tanks in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a terrible time.
Did he have an anger about that in throughout his life? Or?
No, I wouldn't say an anger. You know, I mean, he left the country immediately. I mean, if he would have stayed, he would have probably been stripped of his ability to work. Most of the people who stayed ended up doing sort of menial jobs, like Václav Havel, for example, you know, was a stoker in a boiler room. And A former president became a forester.
Your father had already established a reputation as a script editor and a script writer and a producer before he left Czechoslovakia, but he went on to make a major contribution to American script writing or screenwriting after that. What exactly did he do?
Well, what he said was, you know, his expression for it was he was shipped over in the wrong box or the wrong container, and he was shipped over as an educator, which was one of his roles, but he thought of himself primarily as a producer, dramaturg of film and a writer. And in the new situation, what they wanted from him was, you know, the success of the film school recreated in America. So he became the dean of the American Film Institute, which was a new institution at the time. And it was, you know, the students at that time were people like Terrence Malick and David Lynch and a lot of the main actors sort of in the 70s, you know, the new wave of the American cinema in the 70s.
It was traditional one time for the tailor to son become a tailor and the cobbler's son to become a cobbler. Did you feel it was traditionally obliged for you to become a screenwriter like your father?
In a way, my father helped channel me rather subtly into this, and so eventually I ended up, you know, working with him and doing some workshops with him and that sort of thing. And my first big writing job was a production rewrite on location in China of a film that was the first Chinese-French, or Chinese-foreign, in fact, co-production. So I went over there and I was, like, on the set fixing the
you
script.
You were there with your pen and paper, correcting the script, writing new scenes, giving,
yeah,
developing characters.
The hardest thing you can do is a production rewrite is the technical term for that, and it's actually on location with everybody waiting around, and the script was not ready to go, the clock was running. You know, there were actors and crew waiting around for the script, and I was collaborating with the director to get it ready or get scenes ready for the next day. So the stress and the pressure is quite intense, and the people I was working with were quite capable of generating stress. So it was really a trial by fire in that sense, you know. And so it happens, you know, I mean, it happened to Francis Ford Coppola on Apocalypse Now, for example, where he was flying people into the Philippines and trying to get them to rework the script while he was already shooting.
In Los Angeles, where you live part of the year, there's something like 10,000 screenwriters signed up to the Screenwriters Guild of America. It's a big industry. We forget that writers are kind of like industrial workers in Los Angeles, really, aren't they?
They are, yeah. In fact, I mean, at one time it was a 9-to-5 job, you know, in the old studio system. And as Louis B. Mayer said, you know, in those days, screenwriters are the highest paid secretaries in the world, you know. But I think it's changed quite a bit, but it is still a much more of like an industrial situation. And, you know, the school I teach at, USC, the University of Southern California, you know, it's really like a factory to produce the talent for the industry, you know.
Can you tell me about the sequence approach to making films?
It's obvious that, you know, when you're telling a story, you're working with tension. In other words, you're working with the audience's expectations within the story and their feelings of hope and fear. I don't think there's anything revolutionary about that. I think that's just something that's part of storytelling. And, you know, from Aristotle onwards, there's always been some attempt to codify that and have some understanding of it that's theoretical, right? But basically, you know, people are aware that within a scene you have attention, so that's the smallest unit of the action. And I think most people are aware that in the overall story there's an overarching tension usually that's at work. So this is just another way to break it, the whole story down into smaller units within which there is also a tension at work, and to look at how that can contribute to the audience interest being sustained, and in that feeling of hope and fear being sustained. So, you know, in a sense, my father was the first one to, let's say, express it as clearly
in that shape,
but it's something that's been in cinema. In fact, he always traced it back to the changes between reels, which came at sort of natural break points.
Yeah. I always thought it came from theatre, the Act 1, Act 2, Act 3. I always thought it came from Shakespearean theatre.
Actually, the sequences, you know, because there used to be 8 reels in a feature-length film, so, and within each one, at the beginning, they would have the fade to black or the crossfade or whatever, and so that actually conditioned audiences. My father was never doctrinaire about that. I think there are like books that you read about screenwriting where that's kind of a doctrinaire approach. You know, you read Sid Field and he says on page so-and-so this has to happen, on page so-and-so that has to happen. My father was more of a, and actually it's my approach also, you know, I think the thing is to see if the story is working or not, and then if it's not working, to diagnose why it might not be working, you know, and maybe some of these tools can be useful, but you don't want to, you know, use a hammer to fix everything, you know, so it, like, different tools are useful at different times.
Martin Daniel was in Dublin this week.